You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom. Welcome to the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast designed to help you save and transform your marriage into a relationship that you'll treasure for your entire life. Now, today is a very special day. I have the honor of giving you an interview that I had with Gary Chapman. Dr. Gary Chapman is the author of Five Love Languages. The Five Love Languages is a book that focuses on how to show your love to your spouse. Now, it assumes that we all have a certain love language, a way of showing love and a way of hearing love. This idea is elegantly simple, as you'll hear as we do this interview, but it's such a powerful idea when you grasp it. It's so powerful that I had to go straight to the source, and Dr. Chapman was kind enough to sit down with me and talk with me about his ideas about love languages, and I wanted you to have that opportunity to hear it straight from him. Now, this idea has been spread throughout the world. Dr. Chapman's book has sold over 11 million copies around the world, and this is an amazing book, and I think you're going to find this interview with him great. Dr. Chapman is a wise man, but is also warm, caring, and giving, and this is your opportunity to really take that in, to really hear a message about how to speak your spouse's love language. Now, one of the things that we talk about in this interview, later on in the interview, is doing a little marriage experiment. And because of that, I decided to put together a resource to help you do that interview. So if you'll notice, if you're on the webpage, if you're at SaveTheMarriage.com on the blog, that's at SaveTheMarriageBlog.com, you'll notice that there's a link at the bottom. Now, if you're listening somewhere else and you're listening by iTunes or Stitcher and you want to get to that report, just type into your browser, SaveTheMarriage.com/Chapman, and that's C-H-A-P-M-A-N, Chapman, and that will put you right on the page to find that, and you'll just notice at the bottom of the blog post, there's a place for you to get that. You're going to want that because if you are working on your marriage, this marriage experiment can actually transform your relationship in ways that are incredibly powerful. So without any more going on about that, let me give you the interview with Dr. Gary Chapman. Gary, thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited about this, and I've already told you, I've talked a lot about your material on this already. I have recommended your book over and over, and the reason is because your idea is, in my mind, just elegantly simple. I mean, the idea is one that I don't have to define a lot. So what I want to do, and the reason I want to talk with you, is to get it from you instead of me trying to interpret what you're saying, for you to talk some about what it means to this love language. So let's talk some about what you mean by love language and talk some about what those five love languages are. And then let's talk some about how you discovered the love languages.
Yeah.
And then talk some more about what to do with that.
Okay. Well, it's good to be with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I use the term love language. I'm paralleling on spoken language. You know, if I speak only English and you speak and understand only Chinese, I can speak English all day and you don't get it. And the same reality is true in love. If I speak love, let's say, in words, I give affirming words to you. But if that's not your language, if what you understand is actions or acts of service, then I can tell you all day long how wonderful you are and how much I appreciate you and all these accolades, and it'll be like water off a duck's back. You won't get it emotionally because I'm not speaking your language. I'm speaking my own language. So that's the basic concept, that if you want to be effective in communicating, you have to learn to speak the other person's language. So in love, it means you have to learn how to communicate love in a manner in which the other person will get it. It's not whether or not you're sincere. You can be very sincere and be expressing your love to your spouse or anyone else, and they don't get it emotionally because you're speaking your own language and not speaking their language. So that's the basic concept. And what I share is that I'm convinced that there's fundamentally, and I can tell you how I came to these, but fundamentally five languages of love, five ways to express love emotionally, whether you're talking about husband to wife or parent to child or really any basic human relationship. One love language is words of affirmation, which I just mentioned. It's using words to affirm the other person. You can focus on the way they look. You can focus on their attire. You look nice in that outfit. You can focus on their personality. One of the things I like about you is you're so optimistic. I love that about you. You can focus on their character. One of the things I appreciate is you're a person of integrity. I know I can count on you. You can focus on anything, but it's affirming them in a positive way. You can speak the words. You can write the words. I guess you could sing the words, Lee.
Write a song.
Yeah, I couldn't sing, but some people could sing. Yeah. But you're using words to affirm the other person. There's an ancient Jewish proverb that says life and death is in the power of the tongue. You can kill your spouse, or you can give them life by the way you talk to them. So words are really powerful. For some people, they're super powerful. But words speak to everybody. All these languages, you know, you can receive love in all the languages, but your heart language is the one we're going to be shooting for. Now, I meet people, like a lady some time ago said to me, she said, Gary, I know it would be good if I could give my husband some positive words. She said, but to be honest with you, I can't think of anything good to say about the man. And I said, well, does he ever take a shower? And she said, well, yes. I said, well, how often? She said, well, every day. I said, if I were you, I'd start there.
You smell nice. After you shower.
That's right. That's right. I said, look, there are men who don't. Yeah. You know, if he takes a shower, tell him. I appreciate you taking a shower. Yeah. So this is one of the fundamental languages of love, is words of affirmation. A second language, and these are in no particular order, but a second language is gifts. It's universal to give gifts as an expression of love. My academic background is cultural anthropology. I did an undergrad and a master's degree in cultural anthropology before I studied counseling. We've never found a culture where gift giving is not an expression of love. It's universal to give gifts as an expression of love. The gift says they were thinking about me. Mm-hmm. Look at the gift they got for me. Now, I hasten to say the gift doesn't have to be expensive. To guys, I say, look, you can get free flowers most of the year. Just go out in your backyard and pick one. That's what your kids do. Mm-hmm. And I ask, how many mothers have ever received a dandelion from your kids? And most mothers have. And then I say to the guys, now, guys, I'm not talking about dandelions. Don't go give her a dandelion. And if you don't have any flowers in your backyard, your neighbor's yard, mm-hmm. ask them. They'll give you a flower. Or you could go to a funeral and ask the family. They'll give you a flower. I did that not long ago, Lee. I went to a funeral. And after the funeral, the church had a luncheon for the family. And I went to the luncheon. And I walked in and I noticed they had vases of red roses. So when I got ready to leave, I said to one of the ladies, I said, you mind if I take one of those roses to my wife? She said, oh, Dr. Chapman, you can have this whole vase. I go home with 2 dozen red roses. I told her where I got them. She still likes them.
Does that mean your wife, one of her primary languages is gifts?
No, it's not.
It's not. Okay.
It's not.
That was an extra.
That's just extra credit. So gifts is a powerful love language, and for some people, it's their primary love language. You know, you can pick up a stone in a city parking lot and take it home and give it to an 8-year-old boy and say, hey, man, I found this today. I thought about you. Look at the colors in this. I want you to have this. If gifts is his language, you'll find that stone in his dresser drawer when he's 23, and he'll remember the day you gave it to him. Mm-hmm. Because it spoke deeply to him. Gifts.
Before you move beyond gifts, your point is so interesting, because I've had people say, oh, yeah, my spouse, you know, they love gifts. And I'm like, well, why aren't you doing that? And their response is because of the expense.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is it really is not about the value of the gift.
No.
It's the thought behind it.
Yeah. You know, we've always said it's the thought that counts. Mm-hmm. But I remind you, it's not the thought left in your head. Mm-hmm. It's the gift that came out of the thought in your head.
Right.
But yeah, you don't have to spend money. You know, you can find gifts just walking down the street, you know, and you see a feather and you pick it up and you blow it off and you take it home and you explain the symbolism. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the wing. Is that the wing beneath my sails?
Anyway. Yeah, the wind beneath my wings.
Yeah. You know, You can find them just walking around, or you can make gifts that are very inexpensive. So now, you know, if you have plenty of money and you're buying all your gifts at the dollar store, then that, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. If you got plenty of money, fine, you can spend money, but you don't have to have lots of money to give gifts. And then number three is acts of service, doing something for the other person that you know they would like for you to do. In a marriage, that is such things as cooking a meal. Mm-hmm. That's a huge act of service. Yeah. And then there's washing dishes. There's vacuuming floors. There's getting white spots off the mirror, cleaning the toilet, walking the dog, mowing the grass, washing the car. Anything that you know your spouse would like for you to do. You know the old saying, Lee, actions speak louder than words. Mm-hmm. For some people, that's true. Yeah. Not for everyone. But if this is their love language, then actions speak louder than words. And this happens to be my wife's love language. That's why I vacuum floors, I wash dishes, I take out the trash, I have a happy woman.
Yeah. You know? I tell you, an interesting story, and same with my wife. That's one of her love languages. And I didn't realize it until one day she was saying, you know, I make coffee in the morning. That's kind of my thing. And my reason is because somebody needs to make coffee. It's got to be there. And so I would make her coffee. I'd make, put it the way she wants. And I noticed at restaurants, she would say, here, can you make my coffee the way I like it? And I'm like, you know how you like your coffee? And then one day she just said out of the blue, you know, I feel really loved when you make my coffee. I don't miss making coffee anymore.
Sure
if that's what it takes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so sometimes, you know, you're just doing natural things that could hit the mark. Yeah. What you're talking about is aiming. So one of those places that might be a place to aim is acts of service.
Yeah, acts of service is a possibility. That could be their primary love language. Mm-hmm. And typically they'll complain about it. If this is their language, they'll complain about it. They say, you don't ever help me, mm-hmm. you know. I remember when my wife said, you know, I was giving her all these accolades. I was speaking my language, which is words of affirmation. I was telling her how beautiful she was, how glad I was I married her, how much I loved her. And one day she said, you know, you keep on telling me I love you, I love you, I love you. If you love me, why don't you help me? I was blown out of the saddle, mm-hmm. you know, because in my mind I was loving her. Mm-hmm. In her mind, if I loved her, I'd be helping her. Mm-hmm. So acts of service and then quality time. Giving the person your undivided attention. I don't mean sitting on the couch watching television together. Someone else has your attention. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about sitting on the couch with the TV off, looking at each other and talking to each other. And I ask couples, have you ever tried this? Sitting on the couch with the TV off, looking at each other. It can be scary at first, looking at each other and talking. Or taking a walk together and talking with each other, or going out to eat, assuming that you talk to each other. You know, Lee, I don't know if you've ever noticed, you probably have, in a restaurant, you can almost always tell the difference between dating couples mm-hmm. and married couples. Mm-hmm. Dating couples will look at each other and talk. Married couples sit there and eat. Mm-hmm. I was in a local cafeteria recently by myself, just popped in for lunch to get a quick bite. I sat down. There was a couple that was in my, just a few yards away from me, and I just watched them. I judged them to be in their 50s. They never said a single word to each other. The whole meal. I knew they were married.
They were there to get fed.
They were there to get food.
And only food.
Yeah. So, undivided attention doesn't necessarily mean that you're always carrying on deep conversations. That's one of the, I call them dialogues, one of the dialects of quality time is conversations, quality conversations. But it can also be doing something together, you know, working in the garden together. And you're not having great conversations, but you're doing something together. It's that sense that we're doing this because we want to be together. So it can be any number of things as long as the focus is not on the activity, but the focus is on each other, being with each other. You can play tennis together as long as the focus is not on tennis. It's on us being here together doing something that at least one of us enjoys, you know. So quality time. And then number five is physical touch. And we've long known the emotional power of physical touch. That's why we pick up babies and hold them and kiss them and cuddle them. And long before the baby understands the meaning of the word love, the baby feels love by physical touch. So in marriage, I'm talking about such things as holding hands, kissing, embracing, the whole sexual part of the marriage, arm around the shoulder, driving down the road, you put your hand on their leg, sitting around the house, and they walk by, and you trip them. I'm kidding. But for some people, physical touch is their primary love language. Mm-hmm. This is what makes them feel loved. So the basic concept is simple, that out of those five love languages, each of us has a primary love language. Now, we can receive love in all five, as we said earlier, but one of them speaks more deeply to us emotionally than the other four. That's your primary love language. Again, very similar to spoken language. All of us grew up speaking a language with a dialect. I grew up speaking English Southern style, right. Okay? But all of us grew up speaking a language with a dialect, and that's the one we understand best. Same thing is true with love. Mm-hmm. Now, people say to me, Gary, I don't know. I think two of those are just about equal for me. And my response is, fine. We'll give you two love languages. We'll call you bilingual. But most of us have a primary, a secondary, and then the other three fall in line under that. In a marriage, seldom does a husband and wife have the same language. It happens, but not very often. And if they do have the same language, they'll have different dialects within that language. And by nature, we speak our own language. Whatever makes me feel loved is what I do for my spouse. But if that's not his or her language, it will not mean to them what it would mean to me. So we can be very sincere, we can be expressing love, and we can miss each other. In fact, I believe there are thousands of couples that are sincere. They are expressing love, but they're not connecting because they're speaking their own language and not the other person's language. So the fundamental reality is we have to learn to speak the language of the other person. And when you do, emotionally you connect. I like to picture a love tank inside of us, an emotional love tank, and the love tank starts to fill up when you start to speak the right language. And the emotional climate between the two of you is radically changed. And so it's a simple concept, but it has a profound impact upon the emotional climate of a marriage.
Yeah, you say it's simple, and I think it's elegantly simple, not necessarily easy, yeah. Because there. I mean, it's kind of, it is like learning a foreign language. You stumble across it, and yeah. And most people's tendency, if it's, you know, you kind of use the language metaphor, most people's tendency is to not want to try out. You know, if you're taking a foreign language,
yeah.
The hardest thing is to try it out. And then suddenly you realize that you try that on with somebody else and they actually are receptive to it. They're yes. happy you tried to speak their language, and yeah. you don't have to be fluent. You
yeah.
just have to be trying. So I think that's an important kind of transition here that people – are looking for that language. So a couple of questions that come out of that. One is, why is it that couples might get together and fall in love, not speaking the language, and then not figure that out for a while?
Yeah.
A certain amount of time, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what happens is, you know, the in-love experience, we are pushed along by emotions. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about falling in love or being in love. That kind of love starts with an emotion. Mm-hmm. I call it the tingles. We get this tingle, this warm, bubbly feeling for someone. And then we start going out for hamburgers, and it gets tinglier and tinglier. And it literally, in its full-blown stage, it becomes an emotional obsession. Mm-hmm. You get obsessed with them. You can't get them off your mind. You go to bed thinking about them. You wake up thinking about them. They're the most wonderful person you've ever met in your life. That's the way you are when you're in love. But what we were not told, at least I was not told, is that the average lifespan of that in-love experience is 2 years. Mm-hmm. We've studied it. Dorothy Tenney, Bridgeport, Connecticut, long-term study. Average 2 years, we come down off the high. And I typically say to people, let's be glad we come down off the high, because if we didn't, you'd have to close down business, industry, church, education, because it's hard to get anything done when you're in love,
yeah.
because you're obsessed with that person and being with them, and you feel like you're going to be happy forever. And when you come down off that high, I know for me, when I came down off the high, I was disillusioned because all of our differences emerged, and we found ourselves arguing with each other and said nasty things to each other. that we never would have dreamed of saying when we were in love. And before long, we didn't even like each other, you know? And I was wondering, why did we get married? And I was feeling like I married the wrong person. And having counseled people for 35 years, I found out I was not the only one who had that thought. I married the wrong person. It's not going to get any better. And so people are counting on that euphoria to carry them through, and it doesn't. And they come back down, they're in the real world, and they have conflicts, and every couple has conflicts. They don't know how to resolve conflicts, so they end up arguing, hurting each other, withdrawing from each other, and live in the same house as roommates for a while, and then one of them gets the tingles for somebody else, and the whole thing starts over again. And now, in that, typically they think, with this new person, I found my soulmate. I'm going to be happy forever. And in 2 years, they come down again, and now they go through the same thing. That's why I challenge people, you know, let's give up the myth that I'm going to find this soulmate and I'm going to have these feelings forever. It's not going to happen. You have to learn how to love people when you come down off the high. And that's where the love language comes in. Once you come down off the high, if you have learned the concept of love languages and choose to speak each other's love language, you hardly miss the euphoria because you do, you still feel loved. But if you don't get this concept and you just do what comes natural, you will, the emotions evaporate and the differences emerge, and you follow the scenario that I just discussed. So that's why I think the love languages, it's helped so many people rediscover emotional warmth in their relationship. And that's why it's been so helpful and so powerful.
Yeah, that the that change over that I think is so disillusioning because people think, oh, I mean, this is love, you know, that feeling. And I've talked about that as the shift from an adrenaline-based attraction to endorphin-based. And the difference is that an endorphin-based, the feeling comes from your actions instead of, you know, that that more hormonal driven piece, it's making choices to love. And I think where that really, when we talk about the love languages, really gets fouled up is people are like, well, why were we expressing our love to each other before? And my response is, well, because you were using a shotgun then. Every approach possible was going into it. You know?
Absolutely.
So words were going and touch was going and time was going. And so you were hitting everything just because of that obsessive kind of nature of it.
Yeah. When you're in love, you're going to do anything and everything to show them that you love them. Yeah. You're right. You'll end up speaking all five.
All five going that way.
Absolutely.
And then you default back to that. And one of the things that I noticed, and I wanted to ask what you saw in that, is that sometimes when people get to that out of love feeling, that it seems like their primary love language is almost the most tender spot for them, that they are most cautious when the person kind of tries to get to that love language. Is that an experience you notice? And
well, I think sometimes that does happen, especially if let's say they go to a lecture and they hear me or somebody else talk about the love language. Both of them hear it, and then they try to decide what their love language is, and then one of them tries it and they haven't done it. They've never spoken words of affirmation, and now they try saying it, or they haven't been helping around the house, and now they start helping. And almost immediately the person's thinking, well, they're just doing this because they heard this seminar. It won't last but a week. Yeah. It'll be over, you know. And that's why it's important to not only to recognize the concept and choose to speak their language, but to do it in a consistent manner on a regular basis over, you know, over a lifetime, really.
So let's talk some about it, because one of the processes I talk about for people is that they follow the three C's of their plan of action. And so I'm big on this plan. And the three C's for me are to be calm, constant, consistent. Sure. And the calm is, you know, to get away from the frantic, I've got to save this piece. The constant, consistent, though, is where I think it's important that they are, you know, instead of, oh, I'll speak something nice to them, or I'll do something nice for them, or I'll try to touch them nice, and then in 3 weeks, oh, I need to do that again. They need to do and the consistency is that they've chosen their approach. So one of the things that I know in your material is you're big on lists. And it seems to me that this is part of why you see that important. How might somebody, let's say they've kind of noticed some things that make their spouse feel loved, and that might be an important thing for us to kind of talk about, is how you identify for a much more hostile environment, that love language. But then how do you do that consistently? How do you make sure that you lock that in?
Well, I think it's a conscious choice. You know, I often say to people when I've shared the concept, I say, I have given you information mm-hmm. on how to speak the other person's language, but I can't give you the motivation.
Yeah.
One man said to me, he said, Dr. Chapman, you know, I read your book and I took the quiz and my wife took it and she told me her love language was acts of service. He said, I'll just tell you right now, if it's going to take my washing dishes and my vacuuming floors and my taking out the trash for her to feel loved, you can forget that. Mm. So he had the information, but he consciously was making a choice not to speak the language. I said to him, that's your choice. If you want to live with a wife who has an empty love tank, that's your choice. I said, for me, if washing dishes and vacuuming floors and doing the laundry is going to make my wife feel loved, I say, give me the vacuum, bring on the laundry. You know, I would much rather live with a woman who has a full love tank. You know, I lived for years with my wife in the early part of our marriage, and she had an empty love tank. Then we discovered how to love each other, and now I live with a wife who has a full love tank. I'm telling you, it's two different women. It's the same woman, but she's very, very different when her love tank is full. So hopefully a person, a man or a woman, can see the motivation of this, that living with a person who has a full love tank is a much more pleasant lifestyle. And so, but it's still a choice. And then it has to be made consistently. The choice is made consistently. See, often people will get the idea, well, I'm going to try this for 3 weeks and see what happens. So they'll speak their spouse's love language once or twice a week for 3 weeks. And then they say, well, nothing happened. Mm. You know, they didn't respond any differently. And I say, look, it takes more than 1 or 2, 3 weeks, you know, to change the emotional climate here. I usually challenge people to a 6-month experiment. I say, let's try this for 6 months. Once you identify their language, let's speak it at least once a week for 6 months without any, not sitting around waiting for them to change or do something different. You're just going to do this consistently for 6 months and let's see what happens. And over and over and over again, I've seen the other person melt and begin to reach out and reciprocate. It's the whole idea that love stimulates love. Mm-hmm. And when one person is willing to step out on the limb and say, I'm going to be the one to take the initiative here, I'm going to love them no matter what. And you do it in the right language. And I can't guarantee, obviously, that a person will reciprocate because you can't make somebody love you. But because we all so desperately need love, when you do speak their language consistently over a period of time, something happens inside of them. Emotionally, they warm up to you because they're receiving from you what they desperately need. And so your love stimulates their love.
Let's talk some more about this 6-month experiment, because I really like some major pieces of that. A major piece of that is that you have no idea what the outcome is going to be. There's right. no way of predicting it. Another major piece, and I use the game as not kind of it's fun, but you kind of gamify it. You create the environment where the person can try it out without having any idea what's going to happen, with great possibility on the other end, and without expecting it to immediately come back to them. And I think that's one of the big traps that people get in. They're like, oh, I tried it for 2 weeks. I didn't get anything back.
Yeah.
My love language wasn't getting met, so why should I continue that?
Yeah.
The 6 month makes it a different scenario, though.
Puts it in a different framework, yes. You know, I sometimes say to people two things. If you're in a very, very difficult marriage and you just feel like there's no hope and you're ready to give up, you feel like you've tried everything, I say, let's do one more try. Mm. And here's the approach I take. It's a two-pronged approach. Number one, what if you sit down, and preferably sit down with God, and just say, you know what I live with, but where am I failing in this relationship? And whatever comes to your mind, you write them down. And I suggest you confess them to God and receive His forgiveness. Then go to your spouse, whom you have been condemning for 3 years for their failures, and you say to them, I've been thinking about us. In fact, the other night, I actually asked God to show me where I have been failing you. And a whole bunch of things came to my mind. And I wrote them down. And I'd like to share these with you and ask you, if you can, to forgive me for these, because I feel like I have failed you in these ways. and you read them to them. And then you say, if you can find it in your heart, I hope you can forgive me. Now, maybe they will, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll say, I don't want to hear your list. Or maybe they'll say, after you've read the list, it's too late. Mm-hmm. Maybe they walk away and they rebuff it. But they walk away from hearing those words from you, and they start thinking, this is different. For the last 3 years, all I've heard is condemnation. Now they're acknowledging that they have failed. Whoa. So you see, something's happening in their mind already. Then you start speaking their love language. You don't even have to discuss it with them. You just start speaking their love language. And now they're seeing positive things coming in after that confession, these positive things happening. And it continues. It doesn't stop in 3 weeks. It doesn't stop in 3 months. It's still going on at 4 months and 5 months and 6 months. And somewhere along that line, that person many times will start saying to you, is there anything I can do to help you? Wow. You can tell they're turning now and they're reaching out to you, and you tell them whatever it is that they could do to help you. And so they'll start asking questions of you, what they can do to help you. And you can teach them to speak your love language, even though they don't even know the concept. Mm-hmm. They may never have read the book. They may have never heard the concept. But because you took the initiative to acknowledge your own part of failure, and you took the initiative to reach out and speak their love language, something happens inside of them that makes them reach out and say, look, I've got to do something here. And they start reaching out to you. So I really believe that love is the most important and powerful weapon in the world for good. Mm. And if you speak the person's love language over a long period of time, you're doing the most powerful thing you can do to influence them. I use the word influence because we can't control them. We can't make them love us. We can't make them change, but we can influence them. You know, sometimes, Lee, I talk about, I just give a simple illustration of influence because we do influence each other every single day. You know, if I come home from work and I walk in the house and I find my wife, I give her a hug, I give her a kiss, I talk about, ask her about how her day has gone, I give her a few minutes, and then I say to her, what can I do to help you this evening? Okay, I get some idea from her. I have influenced her in a positive way. On the other hand, if I come home, I walk in the house, I don't find her, don't give her a hug, don't give her a kiss, don't even say a word to her. I just go get me something to drink, flip on the TV, and start unwinding. I have just influenced my wife by ignoring her. Mm-hmm. So in simple ways, every single day, we influence our spouse.
Right.
So what I'm talking about is the power of positive influence, that you choose to speak love in their language, and you are having a positive influence on them every single day.
I pulled out my notebook because it's my Gary quotes. and one of them you said was that requests can direct the flow of love, but demands stop the flow of love. Yeah. That's what you're talking about. The influence is going to be there one way or the other.
That's right.
It's just whether it's going to squash the love or...
Yeah. And when we demand love, when we say, you know, if you love me, you would do this, and we demand love of the person, we push the person away. Mm-hmm. If we request things of the other person, we're simply giving them information. You know, honey, one of the things that would really make me happy, and you share it with them. Mm-hmm. And so you're giving them guidance in case they choose to love you. Here would be a way that they could do that. So I think after you've done a positive influence for, you know, several weeks, you can start making requests of them. If they don't reciprocate and say, what can I do to help you? You can start saying, you know, something, honey, would really help me. And you tell them something. And because they've been receiving love from you in the right love language, there's a good chance they will do that. And so then every week or so, you can make a request of them, and you're actually teaching them how to speak your love language, even though they don't understand the concept.
Okay, so let's say at the beginning of this experiment, and I do think it's important to say, yeah, I'm going to do this 6 months, and it doesn't matter what comes my way. A 6-month experiment is 6 months long, not 2 weeks and then, yeah, oh, this doesn't work. Because a lot of times you're going to get hostility on that front side.
Yeah.
They're going to feel manipulated or pushed. And one of the things I always want to emphasize is that hostility, that anger, is really the hurt coming out.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that is a good representation that you've connected somewhere in there, that there's something going on. And most people go, oh, they're angry at me, then I better back away, rather than going, ooh, they're angry, I've gotten near something important.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I would say, you know, if it's not if it's not just hostility, that's a kind of a threatening hostility, yeah, that the anger response can be an indicator that you're stepping in the right way.
Yeah.
It's just into a scary place for people.
I think that's true. And if you can just ride the course of that anger, as you said, assuming it's not abusive,
right,
you know, expressed, yeah, abusively, and just recognize, okay, something's happening inside of them, and they're expressing their anger, which grows out of their hurt, and so I'm just going to consistently reach out, you know. And if they criticize me, if they say, you know, you're just doing this because you're going to get in that counseling stuff, or you've been reading that book, you know, and they come back and you say, okay, I admit I'm trying to learn how to be a better wife, or I'm trying to learn how to be a better husband. And then you just go back to speaking their language, mm-hmm, on a consistent basis. So you receive whatever hostility they share, but you affirm that what you're doing is trying to learn how to be a better husband or a better wife. And when they see that being true over a period of time, it touches their heart at a very deep place.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is one of those where I always say, let your actions, you know, show it.
Yeah.
Because if you keep saying, I'm going to do these things,
yeah,
you're it's a setup, yeah, first, because, yeah, then the other person's watching. And the second is that it creates a performance piece for you.
Yeah.
It's no longer your actions. It's this, yeah, performance piece.
Just speak the language.
It's just doing it.
Yeah.
Speaking,
right,
the language.
Yeah.
Okay. So how might somebody, I mean, the nicest thing, the top best way is both people are reading the book or taking the quiz and, yeah, and figuring out. But let's say that you've got somebody who has maybe read the book, but has a spouse who, I mean, the marriage is just in trouble. How might they figure out the language to speak?
Yeah. Well, you're right. The easiest way, the best way, the ideal way is that both of them would either read the book and take the quiz at the back of the book or go online. The quiz is online, free, 5lovelanguages.com. If both of them would take the quiz and discuss it, that would be ideal. But you're right. Many times, one spouse will not read a book. They will not take a quiz online. They won't do anything. They won't even talk about us. And so if it's the one person who's going to take the initiative, here's the way you discover the other person's love language. Three things. Number one, you observe their behavior. How do they respond to other people? If in a social setting, they're always patting people on the back or giving people hugs, you can assume physical touch is their language. They're speaking their own language to other people. If you hear them giving words of affirmation, words of encouragement to other people, you can assume that words is important to them. If they're always giving gifts to other people, then you can assume that receiving gifts is probably their language. So you observe their behavior. Secondly, listen to their complaints. What do they complain about? If they say, I can't ever please you, they're telling you that words of affirmation is their language and they don't ever hear words of affirmation, mm-hmm, from you.
Mm-hmm.
If they say to you, I don't think you would ever touch me if I didn't initiate it, they're telling you physical touch is their language. If you go on a business trip and come home and they say, you didn't bring me anything, they're telling you gifts is their language. If they say to you, you know, we don't ever spend any time together. We're like two ships passing in the night. They're telling you quality time is their love language. So listen to their complaints. You know, Lee, often we get defensive when our spouse complains.
Mm-hmm.
If a spouse says, for example, we don't ever spend any time together. If a wife says that, the husband will likely say, what do you mean? We went to dinner Thursday night. You know, we get defensive and come back, you know. But their complaints are giving you valuable information. The complaint is telling you what their love language is. It's one of the biggest clues. And the third clue is, what do they request of you most often? If they periodically are saying, could we take a walk after dinner? They're asking you for quality time. Or if they say, you think we could get a weekend away, just the two of us? They're asking you for quality time. If they say, honey, could you give me a back rub? They're asking you for physical touch. If you get ready to go on a business trip and they say, be sure and bring me a surprise, they're telling you that gifts is their language. If you put those three things together, observe their behavior, how do they love others, what are their complaints, and what do they request of you most often, you can pretty easily figure out what your spouse's love language is.
Yeah, I have a coach who says that complaints are free opportunities for free coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you listen to them instead of that defensive mm-hmm. response, you might get a lot out of that. That's very helpful because I think a lot of people are at that point where they're so disconnected.
Yeah.
That it's not going to be a conversation. They're not going to go to their spouse and say, hey, you have any idea what your love language is? They're going to have to intuit that. And I think they're also going to have to be willing to say, I'm going to show that love language with no expectation it's going to come back. And so there is another part to your love language, which is, for me, looking for the signs of when that other person might have been showing me love and I missed it.
Yeah, I think once you understand that there are five fundamental languages of love, you can look back and see that they were speaking some of those to you.
Mm-hmm.
Not they weren't speaking your language,
right.
But they were speaking some, and you can give it credit. I'll tell you the time where that was most profoundly impressed upon me. I was speaking in a prison where all the men in there were in there for life. It was an open meeting. About 300 men showed up.
Mm.
And I said to them, I'd like to try to explain to you today why you either felt loved or did not feel loved growing up. So I shared the five love languages in that context. At the end of it, a young man stood up. I judged him to be about 30 or 31. He said, Dr. Chapman, I want to thank you for coming today. For the first time in my life, I finally understand my mother loved me.
Wow.
He said, you were given those languages, and I realized that my language is physical touch. My mother never hugged me. He said, the only hug I ever remember getting from my mother was the day I left for prison. He said, but you gave those other languages, and I realized my mother's language was acts of service. She was a single mom. She worked full time. She kept food on the table. She washed our clothes. She washed the sheets on our beds. Mama was loving me. And he was crying.
Yeah.
He understood she was loving him. It just wasn't his language. But now that he understands there's more than one language, he's beginning to get it. She did love me.
It's a retroactive feeling of love.
Absolutely.
It comes back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk some about the tank.
Yeah.
That's an important part, that there's the love tank. And this is not just true for spouses.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we might broaden this a bit and say our kids, everybody has that. Say more about what you mean by a love tank and how that gets emptied and how it gets filled.
Yeah. Well, it's the picture of a gasoline tank in a car. If there's no gas in the tank, the car doesn't go anywhere. So I picture inside every child, for example, an emotional love tank. If the love tank is full, that is, the child genuinely feels loved by the parents, the child grows up normally. But if the love tank is empty and the child feels like they don't love me, then the child grows up with many internal struggles. And the teenage years, the child will go looking for love, typically in all the wrong places. But I believe adults also have a love tank. And if you're married, the person you would most like to love you is your spouse. If you feel loved by your spouse, if the love tank is full, life is beautiful. But if the love tank is empty, and you feel like they don't love me, they wish they weren't married to me, life can begin to look pretty dark. And just as much of the misbehavior of teenagers grows out of an empty love tank, much of the misbehavior of adults grows out of an empty love tank. And so that's why it's so important to learn how to keep the love tank full after you come down off the high of the in-love experience. And that's why it's so important for parents to realize the question is not, do you love your children? Parents basically love their children. The question is, do your children feel loved?
Mm.
You know, they sit in my office, Lee, in your office, and they say at the age of 13, my parents don't love me. They love my brother. They don't love me.
Mm-hmm.
Do the parents love the teenager? Almost always the answer is yes, but the teenager doesn't feel it because they've been speaking the wrong language. So it's so important that parents discover the child's love language, the teenager's love language, and give them heavy doses of their primary, then sprinkle in the other four languages because we want the child to learn how to receive love and give love in all five languages. That's the healthiest adult. But most of us did not come to adulthood having received all five. We received one or two. If it wasn't our primary, then we grew up not feeling loved. So you have heavy doses of the primary love language to a child or teenager, sprinkle in the other four, and you're raising a healthy teenager and a healthy child.
So that love, that tank, I mean, the love tank is just the emptying of it is just daily life.
Yes. Yes, I think all of us need consistently to feel love. It's not a one-time thing. You don't fill up a gasoline tank and forever you can ride that car. Every time you drive a while, it gets empty. And so the flow of life empties the tank. And in our encounters with each other, if we have a number of encounters day after day, week after week, and that we don't receive the filling or renewing of the love tank gets empty. Mm-hmm. So we have to consistently speak the other person's love language if we want the love tank to stay mm-hmm. full. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess there's one other place that I want to kind of have you clarify, because this is one that I hear all the time, which is the assumption that men, that their love language is always touch.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hear that so often that women are like, you know, that's all I am is an object. And yeah. So obviously his language is touch. What do I do about that?
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the case.
It is not. And often men will read the book or they'll listen to my lecture or somebody else's lecture on the five love languages. And they'll automatically say, my love language is physical touch. And what they mean is sex. Mm-hmm. And so I say to them, if I'm having conversation, I say, well, perhaps, but let me ask you a few questions. Do non-sexual touches make you feel loved? Well, they look at me like a deer in the headlights. Are there non-sexual touches?
That's just foreplay.
And I say, well, if you get out of the car going into the mall and she reaches over and holds your hand walking into the store, does that make you feel loved? Mm-hmm. And if he says, not really. Mm-hmm. Well, if she's pouring you a cup of coffee and she puts her hand on your shoulder, does that make you feel loved? Not necessarily. I say, well, then your language is not physical touch. You dislike sex. I mean, all men desire sex, yes, but that's not the love language of all men. Any one of these five love languages can be a man's love language. He will still have a normal, you know, male sexual drive and desire to have intercourse on a regular basis in a marriage, but that's not what makes him feel loved necessarily. You can be meeting his sexual need and he still not feel loved. If words of affirmation is his love language, and he's having sex with you on a regular basis, and you're thinking, well, he surely should be happy, but he hears condemning words from you, his heart is empty. I mean, he's happy that his sexual need is being met in the marriage, but his love tank is empty because you're taking his primary love language, words of affirmation, and you're giving him critical words. And it strikes deeply to his heart, and he doesn't feel loved. That's why many wives are just absolutely blown out of the saddle when their husband, for example, will get involved with somebody else, even while they think, well, I'm meeting his sexual needs. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that he didn't appreciate that, but that's not his love language. And he didn't feel loved and may not have felt loved for 2 or 3 years. And then he gets attracted to somebody else who is speaking words of affirmation to him.
And that process, that repeating process, the 2-year process that we talked about, is that attraction. I mean, that's part of what's wired into us as humans. And the question is how we kind of cordon that off and protect it in marriage. And so what you're talking about, that love tank's empty. And so somewhere along the way, somebody else has started to speak that language, whether it's, you know, again, the shotgun approach or not. But that's what's begun to hit it again.
Yeah. And, you know, on that issue, Lee, I'd just like to really make the point. If you think that the feelings you have for somebody else is going to lead you to an ultimate happiness in that relationship, and you look at your marriage and say, we had too many differences, or we shouldn't have gotten married in the first place, so now you're going to be happy forever, I can tell you, in 2 years, you will be down off that high, and you'll be dealing with similar issues in that relationship, because you will not agree on everything, and you're going to have difficulties and conflicts in that relationship just like you had over here, and you didn't learn how to speak the love languages over here. And what makes you think that relationship's going to be better? Mm-hmm. You're setting yourself up for another failure. That's why the divorce rate in second marriages is higher than the divorce rate in first marriages. At third marriages, it's even higher. So the answer is not running. The answer is learning how to love the person to whom you're now married.
Mm-hmm. It's that repetitive illusion.
Yes, absolutely.
I got it right this time.
Yeah. I sometimes say, you know, if you follow the tingles, this in love thing, if you follow the tingles, you could get married 6, 8, 10, or 12 times, just like they do in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But most of you are not that rich. So.
Yeah. And that, you know, that 2-year average, just to point out, that 2-year average is average.
That's average. That's right. Some may be longer. Some may be shorter.
And some make it through the first date.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So any other pieces that you would recommend? Let's say that you've got a couple, maybe one person is working on it. And any other words of encouragement or pieces you would say, let's point you in this direction?
Well, I would just say if one person is only willing to work on the relationship, I would do everything I can to encourage you. You're moving in the right direction. Don't give up. Invest the time to deal with your own failures. Mm. Maybe you feel like your spouse is 95% of the problem and you're only 5%, but you know you're not perfect. You know, everybody agrees we're not perfect. So what are your imperfections? Where are you failing? Where have you failed in the relationship? You be willing to own those and go confess those to your spouse and request forgiveness. Then you start speaking their love language on a regular basis. And we talked about 6 months as a trial area. You start doing that, and let's just see what happens. You're doing the most powerful thing you can do. You will never regret taking this approach. Many people went through a divorce, later read my book on the love language and said to me, you know, Gary, if I had known all of that before I went through that divorce, I'd still be back in that marriage.
Yeah. I always talk about the courageous action of one, because courageous means you're doing something that's scary and difficult, of working to save a marriage on your own when you've come to the realization that, that you're not ready to let it go. So powerful words. Good. Yeah. Thank you. Gary, again, let's just tell everybody, if you don't have 5 love languages, you can get it anywhere. I wanted a new copy to get autographed, and so I went to Target. There was a Target, but Amazon, Target, I'm sure anywhere that has books is there. And 5lovelanguages.com, and it doesn't matter if they put the number 5 or spell out 5, it gets them to the right place.
Correct, yeah. You know, what's interesting, Lee, is that book has been out for 20 years. Every year it sells more than the year before. It's now sold almost 10 million copies in English and been translated in 50 languages around the world.
Amazing.
Which says that the human need for love transcends all cultures.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would encourage folks to read it. Get a copy for your brother and his wife, your sister and her husband, your mother and your daddy.
Yeah. Pass it out. Thank you, Gary. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Lee. Great to be with you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.